Studio direction was by Jonathan Brown. The editor was Fiona Leach. We've a dose of botanical medicine now here on BBC Radio 4 as Professor Kathy Willis, Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, takes up her story of our changing relationship with the plant kingdom in Plants from Roots to Riches.
Writing in 1636, the herbalist John Gerard told his readers, "The juice of grass mixed with honey and the powder of southernwood taken in drink killeth worms in children." Later in the century, John Robarts, Cornish nobleman and fellow of the Royal Society, scribbled down a cure for epilepsy and vertigo using mistletoe. And botanist William Coles and others spread the doctrine of signatures, a folk medicine from the Middle Ages based along the lines, "Nature makes each growing thing according to its curative benefit." According to this doctrine, damaged parts of the body can be healed by plants which look like them. For example, lungwort, Pulmonaria officinalis, was prescribed for pulmonary disease because the leaves resembled the outline of lungs. These medicinal uses of plants were part of a long and distinguished tradition going back to at least the ancient Sumerians 5,000 years ago. Pliny wrote about it, and the Roman physician Dioscorides wrote a pharmacopoeia of herbs and medicines between 50 and 70 AD, which was circulated enthusiastically around Europe for the next millennium. So it had been known for thousands of years that plants have healing and curative properties, but what was still unknown were the chemical compounds responsible. In 1947, however, science finally found one of the plant world's most powerful weapons against human disease, alkaloids.
They usually have striking, sometimes sensational, physiological effects. Among them are quinine, cocaine and atropine, all of which have important medicinal qualities. Plants containing alkaloids have generally drawn the attention of primitive peoples, and in the cases where they are met with in countries with ancient culture, the knowledge of their properties often goes back to prehistoric age.
That was part of the citation speech for the award of the 1947 Nobel Prize for Chemistry to the British scientist Sir Robert Robinson. The citation went on to praise his investigations on plant products of biological importance, especially the alkaloids. Professor Monique Simmons is a plant chemist in the Jodrell Laboratory at Kew, and as she explains, the alkaloids are a large family of chemicals which plants have evolved for some very specific reasons.
Most alkaloids in plants are characterised by being bitter, and that's why they're often associated with being anti-herbivory, because insects don't really like bitter plants. It's thought possibly to have an effect on the regulation of plant growth, but for us it's of interest because of its medicinal properties. You've got your morphine. There was more interest in morphine for pain control, and you also got the increased use in things like nicotine, which is an alkaloid, and caffeine, another alkaloid that are common to everyday purposes. There was also advance in analytical techniques that enabled us to be able to see a little bit more inside, you might say, plants and identify and isolate the active compounds.
One of Britain's first encounters with this powerful group of drugs occurred right here at Kew. As you may remember, Kew had been receiving plant specimens from all over the world since the late 18th century and had been developing their commercial and research potential. Medicine, in the broad sense, had always been part of this effort. Bark from trees often provided the basis for crude drugs, and one in particular was beginning to show itself effective in the treatment of fevers, especially those resulting from malaria. This was the scourge of European imperialists, with ambitions in the tropics, and caused considerable difficulties nearer to home too. The work of Charles Dickens is full of families of mudlarks squelching out their insanitary existence on the swampy tidal fringes of the Thames and the Wash around Kent, Norfolk and London. These areas, by the mid-19th century, were malaria-ridden. So how could this scourge be held at bay? The answer was to be found in the bark of a tree high up on the eastern slopes of the Andes in South America, cinchona, containing a compound which targets the Plasmodium parasites that cause malaria. Cinchona is a genus containing 25 species and yet growing in a hostile and remote environment for the 19th century European explorers. In these early days, identifying good cinchona bark was a mixture of skill and guesswork. But when whole trees and seeds started reaching Europe, making proper species identification possible, much of the chancy nature of the process was removed. In 1820, the French chemists Pierre-Joseph Pelletier and Joseph Caventou isolated quinine from cinchona bark in the laboratory. A new type of scientist appeared, equally able to handle botanical and chemical data. Perhaps the most distinguished of these was John Elliott Howard, FRS of Howard & Sons, whose collections account for over half of the Kew's 1,000 specimens of cinchona bark in the Economic Botany Collection. The curator is Mark Nesbitt.
Quinine sulfate is one of the four main alkaloids that are effective in treating malaria, which are contained within cinchona. And this bottle of powder here, it's a kind of really important symbol of that ability to extract the alkaloids and then to have standardised medicines of the kind that we might recognise today. John Elliott Howard is a very critical figure in that he brought together a good understanding of which species of tree contained which quinine alkaloids and in which amount. That enabled both higher quality manufacturing at the European end, but it also enabled plant explorers to then go and target species of cinchona for collection in the wild for transplantation.
And did he then start to grow cinchona in this country?
Yes, John Elliott Howard was a great collector. We have his collection of around about 800 bark specimens here at Kew, but he also collected living plants. He grew them in North London, they had glass houses, so he was able to actually observe the trees and analyse bark from trees that he could actually see. So he kind of broke through this geographical barrier. We had botanists and chemists in London or Paris, and the cinchona trees in the Andes.
The dream, however, was to establish cinchona in places under British control. Kew, as usual, was in the forefront. Its plant hunters were sent out to gather seeds and identify the best areas to exploit them. The collector Charles Ledger brought back some beauties in 1865. But for once, Kew took its eye off the commercial ball. Ledger offered Kew his seeds. Kew's directors said they had enough. So Ledger sold his seeds to the Dutch, who went on to huge success in the production of quinine. Underpinned by a mixture of botany and chemistry, the search goes on. Today, local knowledge and traditional culture, both historical and contemporary, continue to provide vital clues for those trying to find and identify medicinal plants. Such leads are crucial when it's estimated that only about 20% of the world's known plant species have been investigated for new compounds with potential medicinal properties. But if we can now synthesise these compounds, why bother to go to the plant kingdom at all?
We still need plants for as ideas because they're real chemical factories. The skeletons that we identify in plants for new drugs is often much wider than we would do as an organic chemist. And of course, most of those compounds have some function. They've evolved by the plants to have biological activity, and that really is a key. The trick, though, is to identify them. And I think the other trick is, you could say, it's been enhanced with our knowledge of things like traditional Chinese medicine. They never use one plant. When we now go to the doctor, we're given a cocktail of drugs. The trick, I think, for us is to identify the cocktail of compounds in the plant that actually are associated with its medicinal properties.
It's a pretty remarkable fact that a quarter of all prescription drugs contain materials based on plant and fungal compounds. These include antibiotics, immunosuppressants, high cholesterol treatments, and anti-cancer drugs. A key breakthrough has been making connections between plant species. If you can select plants that share similar biochemical properties, you can screen them for potential use and plan your selection of which to study next accordingly. At Kew, the herbarium is central to this work.
One of the experiments that started, or actually initially came to Kew, was work that we were doing on a group of compounds, again alkaloids, often called polyhydroxy alkaloids or amino sugars, because of their effect on sugar uptake initially. And as a result of that work, we identified castospermine out of the Moreton Bay chestnut tree. It's a legume, so of course, you know, where best to go to the taxonomists here in the herbarium to find out, you know, what other species, as well as Castospermum australia, which is the initial plant that we started to work on, what are the related species? And we started then to look at species like Longicarpus, Alexia, and others that might contain these compounds. These compounds affect protein-sugar interactions, so they interfere with cell-to-cell recognition. Of course, that's important in infestations with viruses, but also transfer of cancer from one cell to another. So as a result of this work, we identified a range of these compounds that could be used as really tools to study these cell-to-cell interactions. One of them, castospermine from the Moreton Bay chestnut tree, did go through to clinical trials for its use in the control of HIV. Unfortunately, it did have side effects, so it was taken off the market and has gone into research programs now. But what is interesting is that they've synthesized it, they've made it more available to get through the intercells, make it more lipophilic, but the active compound is still very similar to the one that nature had evolved.
But where should we go to look for new sources? A good starting point is drawing together knowledge of traditionally used plants, historical records, and close work with local communities. There are also careful issues relating to ownership of genetic material, since today legislation is rightly much stricter than in Charles Ledger's day.
So, for example, a project that we're doing at the moment in Ghana on antimalarial plants, we're very careful that that knowledge is collected by local scientists in collaboration with the local people. It is lodged within Ghana to begin with so that they actually have documented themselves those traditional uses. We then work with the scientists on their plants, again with benefit-sharing arrangements so that we can transfer some of the testing methods to Ghana, because that's one way to make this type of work sustainable. But it also is a good way to work on plants that are actually used to treat malaria. A mistake can be made when you've identified the actual species, and then a scientist comes and says, well, you've got it growing at Kew. Can we study the Kew plant? And then you find it hasn't got the activity in. Now, that might be because it's not in the right environmental conditions, whereas the plant that's used by the community, in this case in Ghana, possibly is grown in different conditions and has the relevant properties.
So it all comes back to the geography again of where that plant is and what its proper natural environment is.
Very much. The plant takes on some of the characters of its environment and the pressures that plant is under, and that will define its chemistry.
Our ancestors were onto something. There is an untold richness of medicinal resources still out there, not just in the tropics, but closer to home as well. Robinson's pioneering work in 1947 was part of a fascination with the chemical properties of plants. And it's this understanding of the molecular compounds that plants produce that would lead to transformation in our ability to predict plant responses to environmental risk and ecological scarcity. Key research areas that would come to dominate plant sciences in the second half of the 20th century.
Plants from Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Cathy Willis. The reader was Ian Redford. The series is produced by Adrian Washbourne. Never far away from an academic on this station.
Professor Amanda Vickery returns to BBC Radio 4 with more dramatic court cases from the 18th century Old Bailey.
It was a great theatre of humanity. Victims, witnesses and accused. Many of them illiterate, but thanks to the court shorthand writers, we have records of their voices.
I examined a cutter I suspected to be a smuggler. After quitting her, I had fight of another vessel. I gave chase with all the sail I could make.
It's the nearest thing we have to a tape recording of the past.
A new series of Voices from the Old Bailey, starting next Thursday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 9:30.